Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, United Airlines tricked passenger into ICE arrest, lawsuit claims. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on August 7th. On a sunny Sunday morning inside Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport's Terminal 3, a 44-year-old Zimbabwean woman approached her United Airlines flight's gate counter with her husband. A gate agent had called her repeatedly over the terminal's intercom. As the couple stood in front of the counter, the gate attendant made references to patient Gore's boarding pass, odd since she already had it in hand. As Gore approached the counter, three men walked up to her. "Ma'am," one said, "you're going to need to come with us." The men worked for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. For the next 2 weeks in March of this year, ICE detained Gore in three separate facilities in Arizona. A 2011 order from an immigration judge may have been all that saved her from being deported, even though she had legal status, no criminal record, and an 11-year-old American citizen daughter at home. Her detention was harsh. She was denied basic necessities and medical care, and the ordeal disrupted an in vitro fertilization cycle, jeopardizing her chances to have another biological child. The Department of Homeland Security released her after her lawyer filed an uncontested habeas petition. Now, Gore and her husband, Oleoluwa Omotosho, a 36-year-old U.S. citizen from Maryland, are suing United Airlines. Their lawsuit's account of events above ultimately asserts that the gate agent set her up, calling Gore to the counter, knowing that ICE would seize her. The suit states, "Taken together, the near simultaneous intervention, abrupt cessation of the purported airline interaction, absence of any identified airline issue, absence of any visible surprise or inquiry by United personnel, and absence of any further call concerning the purported airline matter or final boarding while plaintiffs remained in the terminal, support a reasonable inference that the encounter was anticipated." The couple is suing United Airlines for negligence and false imprisonment for the airline's role in her apprehension. They allege that the incident cost them more than $75,000 in damages, mainly from legal fees and the failed IVF cycle. When approached by phone, Gore, who is representing herself in the case, declined to comment. ICE acknowledged Phoenix New Times' request, but did not respond to questions. United Airlines did not respond to New Times' request to comment. Withholding of removal. To understand this fiasco, in which a law-abiding immigrant is snatched by the state, held in deplorable conditions, and then freed with a shrug, it's important to understand how Trump is twisting laws meant to protect people who move to the United States seeking safety. Over the past year and a half, the Trump administration has created what Third Country Deportation Watch describes as an opaque web of formal bilateral agreements and behind-the-scenes deals to send increasing numbers of immigrants to countries where they have no ties. As of May, the organization has found, the administration has deported more than 22,000 immigrants to at least 26 different third-party countries since Trump took office on January 20, 2025. This system has become a backdoor for the administration to deport people who couldn't get asylum in the United States but do have what's called a withholding of removal order. Weaker than asylum status, that legal status is nonetheless meant to protect migrants who fear persecution in their home country from being deported there. Undeterred, the Trump administration has made deals with third-party countries to accept deported migrants and then, presumably, in turn, deport them to their home country, effectively bypassing the protection that a U.S. court offered. Meanwhile, this year, ICE has upped its presence at airports nationwide. About a week after ICE agents detained Gore, the administration deployed dozens of agents to Sky Harbor in a poorly explained effort to ease security staffing issues during a partial government shutdown. When New Times reached out to Sky Harbor about Gore's case, spokesperson Gregory Roybal wrote that federal law enforcement agencies can legally conduct enforcement activities at U.S. airports, and added that Sky Harbor is not notified of federal law enforcement activities. Based on Gore's lawsuit and habeas corpus filings in federal court, which got her out of detention in March, her arrest appeared to be targeted. Striving to become a citizen. Her habeas petition says Gore, a citizen of Zimbabwe, has lived in the United States for about 24 years. In 2011, her asylum request was denied, but an immigration judge in Omaha, Nebraska, granted her a withholding of removal. This meant that Gore couldn't be deported to Zimbabwe as her life and freedom were in danger there. By appearances, the administration may have been angling to deport her through this third-party system. Her habeas petition stated that ICE hadn't yet established a destination for her. Her habeas attorney, Edward Way Neufel III, did not respond to New Times' request to comment. In the 15 years since she won the withholding of removal order, Gore has built a life for herself, her habeas petition showed. She has sole legal custody of her 11-year-old daughter, a U.S. citizen. For 12 years, she has worked for USAA, the huge insurer, where she is now a senior manager who models risk. In August 2025, she married Omotosho. According to her habeas petition, she has no criminal history. She was complying with required ICE check-ins. She's been working toward permanent legal status with her employer and her husband sponsoring her. Before her arrest in Phoenix, Gore and Omotosho hadn't encountered any trouble traveling. They'd visited Puerto Rico and Atlanta together, her habeas corpus petition stated. On the morning of March 15th, they'd gone through Sky Harbor's check-in and security and received their boarding passes without issue. Then, everything changed. The undercover ICE agents at the gate didn't offer any visible identification before they physically grabbed Gore and told her she wasn't free to leave, the habeas petition and lawsuit state. The agents said that they had a warrant for Gore's arrest and a removal order, but they only showed Omotosho a warrant without a judge's signature and briefly displayed a piece of paper that mentioned removal, he said in an affidavit in her habeas petition. Omotosho described the agents, all of whom declined to give their names and badge numbers except for one agent named Crossley or Cressel, as rude, dismissive, and refused to meaningfully answer questions. The United employees at the gate didn't intervene or ask the ICE agents any questions. In the days following Gore's arrest by ICE at Sky Harbor, she was shuffled through multiple facilities: the ICE Phoenix Field Office, Florence Detention Center, Eloy Detention Center. Her lawsuit says Gore had to sleep on a mattress placed directly on the floor and use an exposed toilet. She couldn't get a change of clothes, clean undergarments, or basic privacy. She's sensitive to light, but wasn't allowed sunglasses, so she got awful headaches. Breakfast was served at 4 a.m., lunch at 11 a.m., and dinner at 4 p.m., a meal schedule that left her hungry, uncomfortable, and sleep-deprived. It was under these conditions that she lost the chance at a potential pregnancy. Irreparable harm to our family. 4 days after her arrest, Gore's attorney, Neufel, filed a request for humanitarian parole and a motion for compassionate release with the field office, citing Gore's ongoing IVF treatments. ICE didn't respond to that request, according to her habeas petition. Medical documents submitted to Arizona's district court state that Gore was undergoing a time-sensitive IVF protocol that required precise hormone administration, frequent medical monitoring, and highly time-sensitive procedures that cannot be carried out in ICE detention. Gore's fallopian tubes are blocked, court documents state, but she'd created two viable embryos through a prior IVF cycle that her doctor called her only realistic remaining chance to have a biological child. ICE didn't respond to her attorney's humanitarian request, nor did it identify a concrete third-party country to which Gore could be lawfully removed, which Neufeld argued in the habeas corpus petition meant there is no significant likelihood of lawful removal in the reasonably foreseeable future. In other words, ICE grabbed Gore before they had a plan for what they intended to do with her. Her stay in ICE detention forced her to abandon her prepared IVF cycle, the lawsuit states. She resumed fertility treatment after she was released, but without the opportunity of months of physical preparation, instead being confined to squalid, harsh conditions, the cycle produced no viable embryo. In an affidavit in his wife's case, Omotoso wrote, "Her sudden detention, without notice and without accommodation, has interrupted that IVF treatment and places at risk a medically time-sensitive and potentially irreplaceable opportunity for us to have biological children." In its response to Gore's habeas petition, DHS did not oppose her request for release. District Judge Susan Brnovich granted Gore's habeas on March 26th. A day later, Gore was released from ICE detention. She was free once again, but the harm was done. "I have repeatedly communicated to ICE and to counsel that my wife is essential to the stability of our households and to the care of our minor child," Omotoso wrote in his affidavit. "Her continued detention is causing ongoing and irreparable harm to our family unit." Here's a story written by Clarissa Sosin and posted on August 6th. Tempe cops beat the shit out of a cheerleader, now want her jailed. The public watched a cop punch an Arizona State University cheerleader in the face. She got two black eyes. Police got dragged. Now she's being charged with multiple crimes. Her lawyer on Wednesday said the Tempe police are charging Erin Bonner in a misguided attempt to save face for her violent arrest. Untold thousands of people have watched a bystander's video of a Tempe police officer tackling the 21-year-old black woman in the street and punching her. The Tempe Police Department submitted three misdemeanor charges against Bonner. Her arrest outside of CASA on Mill Avenue last month prompted outrage from community members and politicians who criticized the department and called for an investigation into the officers. The police union came out in support of them. The turmoil has clouded the justice process, Bonner's attorney Benjamin Taylor said. "The only reason why the city prosecutor would charge is because of politics, because of pressure from the union, because of pressure from the police chief or the police officers," said Taylor. Tempe police originally submitted two felonies and one misdemeanor against Bonner after the incident. Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell declined to prosecute the two felony charges, aggravated assault and resisting arrest. In a written statement, a police spokesperson said that the remaining misdemeanor for hindering or interfering with police was dropped last week while the department reviewed its charges against Bonner. The department has since submitted new charges of assault, resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, and obstruction to the city prosecutor to review. Taylor said that the city prosecutor should follow Mitchell's example and declined to prosecute because the charges are so similar. "Looking at the video, I think anybody can tell that the officers were the ones who were being the aggressors here," he said. The bystander video of the July 18th incident and body camera and surveillance footage later released by the department showed Bonner standing behind the officers, yelling at them to release her friend. One of the officers ordered her to back up before shoving her with both hands across the sidewalk and to the ground. Bonner stood up and rushed back over, yelling at him. She did not touch the officer. The officer then grabbed her by the arms, tackled her onto a nearby bike, and punched her in the face. The two tussled for a few seconds before another officer helped restrain her. The department initiated an investigation into the officers for their actions. Taylor, who has sued many law enforcement agencies in the Valley, declined to say whether his client planned to sue the department. Arizona law gives her 180 days from the date of the incident to file a notice of claim. If she does sue, ongoing criminal charges could complicate her case or even tank it in federal court. Taylor released a written statement from Bonner's family, saying that the incident brought them anguish. "There are no words to fully describe the heartbreak of watching our daughter be hurt by someone entrusted to protect and serve our community," they wrote. "The hardest thing is seeing the pain and sadness in her eyes that we cannot take away. Expecting public servants to live up to the highest standards of their profession is not an act of animosity toward those who serve with honor. Rather, it is essential to preserving public trust and upholding the integrity and legitimacy of our institutions." According to the department, the officers were breaking up a physical altercation between three men outside the bar when Bonner tried to intervene. Video shows Bonner and two black men, identified by the department as 21-year-olds Jonathan Noriaku and Isaiah Johnson, leaving CASA and passing a white man standing on the sidewalk holding pizza boxes. There's an exchange between the trio and the man. No one has come forward with what was said. The trio starts to walk away when the man with the pizza shrugs and says something. One of the men with Bonner, it's unclear which, turns back towards him. Bonner and the other man pull him away and off camera. A few seconds later, the man who'd been restrained reappears. The man with the pizza thrusts the box at him. The man slaps it in return, knocking it from his hands. His friend grabs him to pull him away. That's when the officers, who were riding past on their bikes, tackle Noriaku and Johnson. Noriaku was charged with assault and disorderly conduct for fighting. Johnson was charged with disorderly conduct for fighting and passive resisting arrest. The officers should have separated the three men and figured out what was going on rather than immediately tackling the two, said Taylor. "There was no fight," Taylor said. "There was no immediate threat or immediate violence. They could have easily gone up and talked to all the people involved, the three people involved, the guy who was holding the pizza, the other two gentlemen, and just say, 'What's going on here?' But that didn't happen. Instead, the officers assumed they knew the dynamics of the situation," Taylor said, "and escalated the violence." Taylor didn't want to say that race was the reason the officers targeted Bonner and her friend so quickly, but he also said it couldn't be ignored. "We never want to, you know, try to play the race card and or say it's a racial issue, but the elephant is in the room," he said. "It doesn't matter what color they are. They should have separated all three of them and talked to them." The city needs to hold the officers accountable, he said, instead of charging his client. "That's what the city of Tempe does," he said. "They mess up. They put charges on Aaron Bonner." Large police sweep in the zone takes homeless activists by surprise. This next story was written by Clarissa Sosin and was posted on July 30th. It was just after 7 a.m. on Thursday morning when the Phoenix police officers rolled up to a curved stretch of road at the intersection of 11th Avenue and Jackson Street. Quickly, the quiet stretch of street outside came to life. A man wearing green pants and no shirt, who'd tucked himself in right up next to the wall of the Andre House of Hospitality, one of the homeless services providers, sleepily lifted his head to see what the commotion was. Immediately, he stood and began to gather his stuff. The officers were conducting a sweep of the Zone, the notorious homeless encampment near downtown Phoenix. While it was disbanded in 2023, the Zone still exists in a smaller form, with fewer people and fewer tents. Its boundaries are 9th Avenue to 15th Avenue, between Jefferson and Jackson Streets. Ask some, however, and it extends all the way from Washington Street to Grant Street. Sweeps happened regularly after a court ordered the area cleared in 2023. But the one on the morning of July 30th came without the usual warnings and with a far stronger police presence, two witnesses who filmed the sweep told Phoenix New Times. When I looked to my right, I saw like a butt-ton of cop cars just ripping around the corner from where I was parked, said Jessica Spencer, one of the witnesses. It looks like they started arresting people, so I got out and started recording. Spencer and her partner, Sophia Alicia, are activists who provide aid to people sleeping on Phoenix's streets. Alicia, who runs the Instagram account Unsheltered Phoenix, regularly films interactions between homeless people and police, including officers' use of a honeypot to trap and trespass people in a city park. She asked to be identified by her first and middle names out of fear of retaliation. The two were out there that morning because Alicia had checked in on a friend the night before and heard through word of mouth that the police might be coming the next day. Phoenix heavily restricted camping in public places such as city sidewalks, alleyways, and roads, and areas within 500 feet of shelters, schools, parks, and child care centers. Alicia said that typically when sweeps happen, officers warn everyone and give them a chance to move their stuff to a temporary location. But this time they swarmed in, and with a lot of patrol cars at that. They were clearly, you know, planning to come through with a hammer, she said. Spokesperson for Phoenix's Office of Homeless Solutions, Kristen Couturier, who responded on behalf of the Phoenix Police Department as well, confirmed the operation in an emailed statement and said the city is under a permanent court injunction to keep the 15-block area around the Key Campus, the hub for homeless services near downtown Phoenix, free of tents, makeshift structures, and biohazards, she wrote. Closing this block was an extra safety precaution that allowed staff to address the trash and debris in the area, work to engage with each person in the area, and offer them services, and allow police to address warrants, camping violations, or other criminal activity, she wrote. Everyone on the block had the opportunity to take their belongings with them, or store their property with the city. Couturier said that 7 people were arrested for felonies. 18 people were contacted for camping and trespassing. If they did not have outstanding warrants, they were issued citations in lieu of detention, she wrote. The city of Phoenix is obligated to maintain safe, clean public spaces that are usable for everyone, and we will continue to maintain this area in accordance with the court order, Couturier wrote. Footage shows the officers arriving and the people who were sleeping or sitting on the sidewalk trying to leave. Officers detain and question them. At least 3 people were filmed being taken away in handcuffs. At least 2 officers on the scene were not Phoenix police. One wore a vest that said probation, and the other wore one that said U.S. Marshals. Alicia and Spencer said that people who could clear out did so. Those who got stuck were checked by the officers for warrants, and if they weren't arrested, they were issued a citation. Once the process was complete, homeless services providers were available to connect people to services. But even the officer of services felt disingenuous, Alicia said. Some people don't want to work with them because it's not right for them yet. they've had a bad experience, or don't trust the providers. And even if they might want to accept the services, that could be difficult to do for many with police hovering nearby. Alicia said she doesn't see the point of the sweeps when all they do is disperse people into the neighborhoods for a few hours. People just don't have anywhere to go, she said. The program continues now with this story written by Clarissa Sosin and posted on August 7th. Arizona has banned these processed foods from your kids' school. Back to school means you're chasing supplies and plotting a new daily commute. It also means sending goodies to school for bake sales, birthday parties, and fundraisers. That old routine got slightly more complicated this year. A new Arizona law forbids certain ingredients from being passed around at school. Some of them are gnarly enough that you're already unlikely to find them in your favorite prepackaged snacks and such. But before you hit the grocery store, make sure you know what you can't send. Starting this school year, all Arizona schools, and by extension, parents and guardians and caretakers of the students who attend those schools, will have to comply with the Arizona Healthy Schools Act, HB 2164, for the legislation nerds out there. The law bans certain ingredients from being served to children in schools, including food families send with their kids. The law doesn't hassle you for what you pack for your kiddo. When you pack food to be distributed in class, that's a different story. Take cupcakes, for example. If your kids really love the one brand of mini cupcakes at the grocery store with the red sprinkles, feel free to send it with them for lunch. Heck, send it every day. But when your child's birthday comes around and you want to send them in with enough mini red sprinkle cupcakes for the class, read the ingredient level. Sprinkles might contain red dye 3 or red dye 40, both of which are no-goes under the new law. Here's the complete list of banned ingredients. Potassium bromate, propylparaben, titanium dioxide, brominated vegetable oil, yellow dye 5 and or 6, blue dye 1 and or 2, green dye 3, and red dye 3 and or 40. Those ingredients can't be served or sold to students during school hours, defined as midnight until 30 minutes after the bell rings ending the school day. The law doesn't cover evening activities or extracurriculars, even those on the school campus, or events that take place off campus or on non-school days. The USDA implemented regulations as well, prohibiting many ultra-processed foods from schools, so it's a lot to keep up with. Here's a handy tool, the Smart Snacks Calculator, to help you figure out if the food you want to send with your kid is up to snuff. The Smart Snacks Calculator is online at foodplanner.healthiergeneration.org/calculator. And finally, a pro tip. The new regulations don't apply to food given to staff and non-students. So if it's really important to your kid to share those red sprinkled cupcakes, feel free to send them as a thank you to the teachers. Or, you know, just pack some fresh fruit. You, us, and a dark cave with potentially 10,000 bats? This next story was written by Jennifer Goldberg and was posted on August 6th. The Phoenix Bat Cave is one of the city's unique attractions, a flood control tunnel in Arcadia that doubles as the summer home of a colony of thousands of Mexican free-tailed bats. Every evening around sunset, the bats leave the tunnel in search of food. It's an impressive sight, a cavalcade of bats streaming out of the tunnel and flying off into the night. The Phoenix New Times is in the middle of its summer membership drive, and our latest perk is a bit batty. We're inviting new and current supporters to join us at 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, August 25th, for an excursion to the Phoenix Batcave. Our special guest will be Angie McIntyre, a bat specialist with the Arizona Game and Fish Department. You can make a contribution to become a member and get an invite. Already a member? Keep an eye on your email for the RSVP. I always like to tell people bats never attack people, and so most of the misconceptions come from the fact that most people have never seen a bat up close. They don't really even see bats unless they go to a location like this and see them flying, McIntyre told Phoenix New Times. But on any given night, there are anywhere from dozens to thousands of bats, depending on where you are in the valley, that are out hunting insects. There are several different species that can cope with the urban environment. And then, as you get into the wilder areas, Arizona is a very diverse state with 29 different species. The event will last about an hour, after which we'll retire to a nearby bar for drinks. You'll need to bring water and wear comfortable walking shoes suitable for flat gravel. You'll get full details on where to park and where to meet in an email. If you've benefited from our reporting, discovered a new restaurant, learned about an important issue, or simply enjoyed reading our coverage, we hope you'll consider becoming a member today and join us August 25th for a visit to the Phoenix Bat Cave. Writer Jennifer Goldberg brings us this next story that was posted on August 5th. Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix offers monthly Pay What You Can Day. The Desert Botanical Garden is one of Phoenix's top tourist attractions, one of the best gardens in the country, according to Vogue magazine, and an all-around local gem that's been delighting visitors for more than 85 years. It's also not cheap to visit. Tickets are $22 for adults and $17 for children ages 3 to 17. But once a month, the garden welcomes the public for Community Day, Pay What You Can Day. There, guests can explore the garden on its five trails: the Sonoran Desert Nature Trail, the Center for Desert Living Trail, the Desert Discovery Trail, the Harriet K. Maxwell Desert Wildflower Trail, and the Plants and People of the Sonoran Desert Trail. Here's what you need to know to take advantage of the Desert Botanical Garden's Pay What You Can Day. When is the Desert Botanical Garden's Pay What You Can Day? There is no specified charge to visit the garden on the second Tuesday of each month. This is subject to change depending on when holidays fall on the calendar and during certain special events. The next Pay What You Can Day of 2026 will be on Tuesday, August 11th. Do I need a reservation? Reserving an arrival time in advance is strongly suggested on Pay What You Can days, as well as paid days. Those who don't reserve a time may not be admitted. What are the Desert Botanical Garden's hours? The garden's hours are currently 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. However, in July and August, the trails are closed from 1 to 5 p.m. Plan for a morning or evening visit. What is there to do at the Desert Botanical Garden? The garden has those five walkable trails. DBG also has a gift shop where guests can buy snacks, drinks, and ice cream treats. The newly reimagined Gertrude's by Tarbell restaurant is now open. Where is the Desert Botanical Garden located? It's at 1201 North Galvin Parkway. How else can I visit the garden for free? Desert Botanical Garden participates in the local Culture Pass program. Culture Pass offers free admission to popular museums and tourist destinations around the state. Passes can be checked out at local libraries. Each pass is good for two free admissions to the attraction. Once the pass is checked out, you've got 7 days to use it. The selection depends on which attraction's passes are already checked out. Meet the bizarre sound machine hidden in the Phoenix Art Museum. This next story was written by Eric Vanderwall and was posted on July 16th. On the lower level of the Phoenix Art Museum, under the one light in an otherwise darkened room, sit an electric keyboard in a wooden housing, a small padded bench, and 16 wooden chairs arranged in three rows. This is The Instrument of Troubled Dreams, an interactive sound installation created by Canadian artists Janet Cardiff and George Burris Miller. The piece, which is on loan from the Diane and Bruce Hall collection, debuted at the museum in June. Cardiff and Burris Miller, who have been collaborating for over 35 years, premiered the work in 2018 at Amsterdam's Oudekerk, a grand church with nearly eight centuries of history, now the city's oldest building, and a space for sponsoring and presenting new art. The keyboard instrument in the installation is a replica of a mellotron, a kind of early electronic keyboard instrument invented in England in 1963, on which each of the 72 keys corresponds to a length of magnetic tape that moves across the playback head when the key is depressed. The instrument operates by playing previously recorded sounds rather than by synthesizing sounds itself. In a standard mellotron, the keys correspond to notes on the 12-note scale, as on a piano. But for Cardiff and Burris Miller's mellotron replica, the keys instead correspond to sound effects, vocal tracks, and short passages of music, in digital rather than tape form, with color-coded labels above each key to indicate its sound. The instrument has, therefore, as Christian Ramirez, PAM's Cone Assistant Curator of Contemporary Art and Director of Engagement, says, been transformed into a storytelling device. The instrument's sound effects, marked with black labels over the keys and occupying the majority of the keyboard, run a wide gamut. Mewing cats, barking dogs in near and far away variations, wading through water, rowing a boat, wind in three variations, gusts, shrieks, and deep, low blowing. Gunshots, police searching an apartment, food being prepared in a kitchen, steam, escaping a valve, and numerous others. About a third of the keyboard's keys, color-coded green, play musical passages, several of which, such as Theme for Troubled Dreams, isolated into seven separate instrument tracks for bass, percussion, cello, strings, viola, brass, and vocals, and Bowed Metal 1 and 2, were composed or improvised for this installation. Other musical selections include a choral setting of Psalm 138 by Dutch Renaissance composer Jan Pieterszoon Sweelinck, who served as the Oudekerk's organist from about 1580 until his death in 1621, and Julius Fuchs's Entry of the Gladiators, a circus classic listeners will recognize at once. Amid the sound effects and passages of music, scattered along the length of the keyboard sit 11 keys, all marked with red labels, simply reading vocal. Each of these keys plays narration by Janet Cardiff, about a minute or so long, connected as a collection of impressions or images, though without any linear or chronological progression that would make a certain sequence the correct or intended one. Some of the tracks are ominous and portentous. I lay still, flat on the ground. I hear the dogs searching for me along the beach. I could see a large ship out at sea, fighting its way through the growing swells. Above my head, the arms of the windmill came crashing down towards me, over and over, louder and louder, as the storm clouds came closer. Others suggest a frightening totalitarian world. She hid behind a secret panel in the wall. When the police came, they searched the whole house. She could hear their loud voices and footsteps, staying hidden for days, slowly drinking her small supply of water and eating her decaying fruit and bread. Yet others partake of dreams' strange logic. Some nights she hears the barking of a dog, but it may be just a log scraping a window, or evoke a journey into the subconscious. She made her way down a circular stairway that led to the lower depths of the barge. Dank, cold air hit her in the face as she descended into the darkness. She entered a dimly lit space filled with decaying machinery. And some, seemingly prosaic pieces of narration, describe the Oudekerk. On Sundays, I used to walk to the Oudekerk in the snow. Services seemed so old-fashioned. Nothing's really changed there. After the service, they served tea and cookies, and I would try my best to make small talk. All these sounds emerge from 23 Paseo speakers placed around the room to produce an immersive experience, one in which you can feel the sound in your body as you play the instrument or sit in the audience, Ramirez says. Indeed, the exhibit can get loud, though not in the way that's felt in the ears so much as in the gut, a visceral sensation. The sounds encircle you and place you in a dystopian feeling setting and story of your own making, she says, adding that the experience mirrors that quality of troubled dreams where you feel uneasy or uncomfortable because something's just a little bit off and all-consuming. Musicians are likely to first approach the keyboard in terms of key centers, scales, and modes, but these concepts do not apply here. Nor does the keyboard demand a linear progression from left to right, or right to left for that matter, though one can play it that way. The keyboard's sounds, musical, vocal, and otherwise, are instead grouped into thematic clusters, according to actions and objects mentioned in the vocal track, with a few subtler correlations of far-apart keys that become apparent over time. These thematic clusters are, however, more suggestions than imperatives. The installation is, as Ramirez puts it, a storytelling instrument, with each key allowing visitors to create their own score or film. Indeed, the instrument offers a range of expressive possibilities, and one experiences a different style, a different sonic atmosphere, a different version of the exhibit, with each person who plays, and more so when more than one player takes to the keyboard, greatly expanding the possibilities, such that the exhibit makes possible successive stages of discovery and creation, first with understanding its mechanics and identifying the thematic clusters, then seeing more and more possibilities for exploring this work of, as Ramirez describes it, sculptural sound. Here's a story written by Benjamin Leatherman and posted on August 7th. Why this Phoenix radio show has championed local music for 10 years. Breaking through has never been easy for Phoenix bands and musicians. Finding an audience can be even harder. Alt-AZ 93.3 on-air personality Monique Mo Rodriguez has been helping with both for the past decade. Since 2016, her weekly locals-only radio show, Homegrown with Mo, has introduced Valley listeners to hundreds of Arizona artists. Every Sunday at 9 p.m., Rodriguez fills Alt-AZ's airwaves with an hour of local music. The playlist is different each time, mixing rising Arizona artists, longtime local favorites, and the occasional genre curveball. Case in point, recent shows have featured local upstarts like East Valley emo band Phantom Spring and pop punkers Perfect Sense. More established Arizona talents like indie pop artist Upsal and singer-songwriter Sydney Sprague are also in the mix, plus artists that don't strictly fall into the alt-rock category. Sometimes I'll make exceptions for bands that don't necessarily fit the alt-rock genre. "It feels like I'm being a little sneaky," Rodriguez says. The good thing about alternative is that there are so many different fabrics that are a part of its quilt, and genre is even a hard thing to define right now anyway. Something I've always wanted to do. Rodriguez, a Valley native, grew up listening to legendary Phoenix alt-rock station The Edge in the late 1990s and early 2000s, with dreams of one day getting behind the microphone. One of her favorite programs was the station's weekly local frequency show. "When I was younger, I'd listen to The Edge constantly," she says. "I felt like they were really championing a lot of the local bands I'd heard about back then that are all big now." That included Arizona favorites like Authority Zero, Jimmy Eat World, The Format, and Funk Junkies. When Rodriguez signed on with Alt AZ in 2014, a locally focused show was one of her pet projects. It became a reality in late August 2016. "It's something I'd always wanted to do," she says. "It felt like there was a hole that needed to be filled when it came to local music. I wanted to showcase all these bands that I'd been hearing about over the years, and they finally gave me the opportunity." It started out small, with Rodriguez closing each weeknight air shift with a song by an Arizona artist, inviting listeners to vote online for their favorite. The winning track got another spin on Friday. "I'd spend time talking bands up and then playing their songs," she says. "I got a good response, so I kept doing it." Homegrown with Mo eventually grew into a weekly hour-long night program that began airing on Sunday nights in 2018. The show's name also had a serendipitous connection to the station's past. Years after Homegrown with Mo debuted, Rodriguez discovered KDKB, which became Alt AZ in 2014, released a series of Arizona Sounds compilation albums in the 1970s featuring local artists like Hans Olsen and Dwayne Davenport. The first volume, released in 1977, had the subtitle Homegrown Music. "I had no idea. Someone sent me a copy of that vinyl record," Rodriguez says. "I was like, wow, this is just really cool. It feels like I'm continuing the legacy of KDKB with the local music. It feels like I've done some good." When Rodriguez started airing local music a decade ago, she scoured the local music scene for band and artists to feature. These days, it's no longer an issue, as Rodriguez says her inbox is filled with submissions from Arizona musicians. "I'm having trouble going through all my emails because there are so many," she says. Over the last decade, Rodriguez has also found other ways to spotlight local artists beyond the airwaves. In 2022, she began staging the Homegrown Sessions, a series of Tiny Desk-inspired live performances in the Alt AZ studio that she paid for out of pocket. While the series ended in 2023 because of funding issues, Rodriguez hopes to revive it someday in a larger space. Both the Sessions and Homegrown with Mo have also introduced Valley listeners to a few breakout acts over the last decade. Rodriguez remembers featuring future indie pop star Upsal long before her national breakthrough. Hardcore act Bite the Hand also found a wider audience after appearing on the show. Rodriguez downplays any role in their respective success stories, though. "I don't say that it's because of me at all," she says. "Ultimately, I just wanted people to hear bands that I was hearing because I love sharing new music. And if it's new music from your backyard, even better." Rodriguez says artists who have been featured on Homegrown with Mo frequently send videos of themselves hearing their songs on commercial radio for the first time. These moments, which Rodriguez says are really magical, are just some of the perks of her job. "People reach out and tell me, 'Thank you for showing me this new band,'" Rodriguez says. "If I can give them just one new fan, It feels like I've done some good more than I've done bad. Why synth punks Snailmate are leaving the desert for life in Europe. This next story was written by Amy Young and was posted on August 6th. What do Arizona and Albania have in common? Not much, honestly, but a new answer to the question is Snailmate. The Phoenix band is equal parts Caitlin Lander, synth and vocals, and Bentley Monet, drums and backing vocals. And together, their skills and energy whip up volcanic, electropunk, nerdy rap, and noisy tunes. But after more than a decade spent building their career in the Valley, they'll soon leave to create from their new home base in southeastern Europe. The duo will play a farewell show in Phoenix at the Rebel Lounge on Thursday, August 13th. In a Zoom chat with the duo, they break down the decision to split. "We have wanted to move for years," Lander begins. "There are a lot of factors. We love touring in Europe. They treat us really well over there. It's fun, it's exciting, the reception to the band is really good, and it's just beautiful. It's something we have always fantasized about. Every time we go back to Europe, it gets better and better, and we make more contacts. It's something that became realistic to us." Europe's scenery has long been a pull for visitors and transplants alike. Still, their decision is also driven by some of the ugliness and hate currently permeating the U.S. political and social landscape. A big part of it was Trump getting reelected, and a lot of things that have been happening in the country, Lander says. "We talked about it last year, and we weren't sure if it was possible, and then things kept happening. I don't need to tell you what's been going on, but it's scary for us and for our families. For Bentley, as a trans man, it's really terrifying. So that's a big part of it, too. With all of these things combined, and with our partners being so gung-ho and supportive, we thought, we can make this happen. Moving to Europe sounds nice, doesn't it? But as Team Snailmate can tell you, it's not easy. We're bringing our partners and our pets," Monet says. "I have 3 cats, and he has a dog and a cat. And it's a lot of paperwork, and it's very stressful." Tirana, Albania's capital, is Snailmate's landing spot. They say there are plenty of reasons why the city was an easy choice. "There are people that want to get to know you, and there are shops and bakeries, and you don't have to go far to get a good meal," Lander says. "Everything you need is close." Not having a car is an exciting prospect for Lander and Monet, and Tirana offers walkability that they've been craving. "Where we're going to be living, we're not even going to have to drive. And when we go on tour and stuff, we're going to just rent a car," Monet explains. "But where our apartments are, we can walk to the grocery store, multiple grocery stores, coffee shops, everywhere we need. We're figuring out our practice space thing, but that's probably going to be walkable as well, or the bus. So it's going to be nice not to have to be reliant on a car." The city's beauty also sealed the deal, Lander says. "Of all the places we've traveled, it's really beautiful. It's near Greece. It's just across the water from Italy. The people are really warm and kind, and the food is amazing." There's also the unavoidable issue of cost, and Tirana fits the bill there too. "The big factor for us right now is it's affordable, and we can make a living with our music and our internet presence and touring a few times a year," Lander says. "Living our dream is an attainable goal." Wanderlust. The band came together in 2015, and traveling has been in the mix since 2019. "The first time we went," Monet says, "was in 2019. We had a booking agent that we paid, and then she totally dropped the ball. We ended up with like 3 shows, and since we already had the plane tickets, we went. We filled in the dates with some other random shows I found. We played some open mics, and we made a bunch of connections. we had a really good time, even though it was terrible circumstances. After COVID, we went over again, just DIY with the people we'd met, and then we went again in 2023, and then this last year, and worked with a booking agent. It was a longer tour. Lander adds, "It was pretty daunting at first, but we learned a lot, because we were forced to. DIY there is actually possible. It seems really intimidating. You're worried about language barriers, culture shock. Especially in Vienna, we spent a lot of time there. But we realized everyone there was willing, probably even more willing than in America, to help book a tour. They take better care of you. They give you a place to stay. They make it a priority to feed you. In Europe, people are excited to have you there," Monet says. "People just show up because they read about it in the newspaper. It's just so different." Snailmate has also toured in Japan and Brazil, collecting fans and friends at every stop. Their shared passion for travel makes this giant move more thrilling than surprising. "One of the things we said when we started this band, and we started touring pretty much immediately, was that we wanted to play everywhere," Lander says. "Everywhere and anywhere. The unknowns about Albanian life as a band have them just as jazzed. As they've been fostering friendships with peers on their travels, they hope to continue developing new relationships and opportunities for artists." Monet has big plans for the Toronto music scene. "I want to start a crazy synth-punk scene in Toronto, where we're going to be living, because I don't think there's any type of music like that right now, so I'm going to start some crazy scene there. I want to try and get all of my friends to come there and play eventually, so I'll start with the European friends and then eventually convince American friends to come." And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for other interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.